Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by SIGGRAPH Asia 2012, in Singapore from November 28th to December 1st. FX Guide is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. This is where we talk one-on-one with top artists doing cutting-edge work, dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. Be sure to check out our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Today, Mike Seymour is going to speak with Ubhijit Ghosh from USC's Institute for Creative Technologies. He was part of ICT's presentations at SIGGRAPH LA 2012 on surface properties, normals, scanning, and reproduction of human skin. He's also giving a half-day course at SIGGRAPH Asia on polarized light in computer graphics. FX Guide is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia, which is taking place from November 28th to December 1st in Hong Kong. Well, the term is in full swing over at fxphd.com. I personally am enjoying the course VFX 220, feature film VFX supervision being taught by Sheena Duggal, using her recent work on The Hunger Games as a case study for the course. It's rare access to the inner workings of high-profile visual effects. I'm also working to improve my knowledge of Adobe CS6 with an audition as well as a premiere class. And then, in Background Fundamentals 225, the more magazine-style, wide-ranging show we do for all members of FXPhD, in the most recent class, Mike Seymour looks at a couple of popular cameras, including the Canon C500 and the Blackmagic Cinema Camera, and a few other interesting gadgets. Anyway, as always, a great term going on now over at fxphd.com, all available at a great price to take your skills to the next level. Now, let's get the latest from ICT.
Ubhijit, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. So I loved your paper at SIGGRAPH, and one of the things that struck me is astounding is how applicable this is to people and the real world. But at the core of it, you are picking up on what is otherwise a kind of an invisible effect that happens, where just naturally in life with just normal objects, light polarizes it, bounces off. Can you tell me about that, and particularly what the Brewster angle is?
Thank you, Mike, for taking the time to talk to me. Yeah, sure. So normally when cameras record images, they're recording the intensity of light that is traveling towards the camera. In this particular work that I presented, we're actually talking about imaging of specific wave property of light that is generally not really discussed or recorded by cameras. And this wave property is called polarization. And in this work, we are explicitly measuring the polarization property to recover surface orientation or shape information of objects. And so you asked specifically about Brewster angle. And so it turns out that this wave form of light, this electromagnetic signal, the polarization actually is the result of two components. One is called the perpendicular component of polarization, and the other is called the parallel component of polarization. Every waveform has these two components. And so the parallel component of polarization is the oscillation of the electric field along the direction of light propagation. And the perpendicular component, from its name, you could probably guess, is the oscillation in the orthogonal direction across the direction of light propagation. So now, when light travels and hits a surface, if it's a typical organic material like human skin or plastic or rubber, in technical terms, such materials are called dielectrics. So then one of these components, the parallel component, actually transmits inside the material, and only the other component, the perpendicular component, gets to reflect, which means that even though the incident light beam may have been unpolarized, which means that these two components had a random orientation, because of the bounce, only one of them survives, resulting in the exited reflected light actually picking up an inherent polarization. And this Brewster angle is the angle where this effect is maximum, which means one of these components, the parallel component, completely transmits and the other component completely survives, resulting in maximal linear polarization. And if you move away from the Brewster angle towards a more frontal direction, then this effect reduces, and in fact, both components tend to reflect more equally. So there is this maximal polarization at Brewster angle of incidence.
So this has been, I mean, this has been known for some time. I think at the beginning of the 1800s, they worked out this idea that light was polarized by reflecting off. It just seems like no one's paid much attention to it in terms of the sort of work that we're doing. And what's really fascinating about this for me is that you're getting this to work in the studio where you've got sort of controlled conditions, but you've also managed to do it outside out under sort of a cloudy overcast condition. And even though maybe the results aren't quite as good, they still seem remarkably good from the paper you presented at SIDGRAPH.
Yeah, so that actually was a surprising result, typically from a surface normal recovery standpoint, because traditionally, to recover surface normals using a technique called photometric stereo, you have to control the incident lighting in a studio lighting condition. So in this case, by going outdoors in a completely cloudy sky, we gave ourselves the complete opposite lighting situation, where we have absolutely no control over the lighting, and essentially it's a single lighting condition, and from that we can recover the surface normal information. And we do this by making the observation that under cloudy skies, the incident light is actually completely unpolarized, which is really the signal that we are actually seeking to record with these different polarizers in front of the camera. And hence, in that sense, that kind of unpolarized lighting in the outdoors is not too different from unpolarized lighting in the studio. So this is why it works out so well.
So if we sort of just take a ball, for example, but let's assume that it has the kind of refractive index, because the Brewster angle is affected by refractive index. Let's assume it has the kind of refractive index of human skin. And that angle is going to be at about, say, 53 degrees. So at 53 degrees, if I shine light that's exactly sort of 90 degrees out of whack with what we want, it would literally eat the light in the sense that it would be absorbed. And if I shone completely the correct, the most polarized in the right orientation light at that 53 degrees, I would get the maximum amount of this effect. And basically you're measuring or recording kind of the variations between those. Is that right? Like just because that, obviously, if you know it's more or less than that, is going to, or it can't be more, if it's less than that and how much it's less than that, that would give you a kind of orientation. In fact, that gives you the normal direction of the surface that it's bouncing off.
That is actually exactly correct. So by imaging these polarization information and figuring out how much of the light transmitted in one of these components and how much it reflected in the other component, it gives us an information about how close or how far away from the Brewster angle the surface normal is, and hence indirectly gives us an information about the orientation of the surface normal with respect to the camera's orientation.
So now I've recorded somehow the amount of polarization, but we need some maths now to get us across the line. And you use the Stokes vectors or the Stokes parameters, which is basically a fairly well understood property of solving for this. Can you tell us about the Stokes parameters?
Right. So the Stokes parameters are what are called the basis sets of polarization. So think of 3D world. If we divide the 3D world into axes, we tend to give it these three principal axes, the x-axis, the y-axis, and the z-axis. So if to represent any position or any direction in 3D space, we can just represent its direction in terms of these three coordinates. Similarly, to represent the full polarization information of a wavefront, we basically rely on what are called the Stokes parameters, and there are these sets of four numbers or four readings, if you will, which represent the complete polarization information. This includes the power of incident light, the horizontal, vertical, and 45-degree orientations of linear polarization, and lastly, the intensity of circular polarization. So any light that is partially polarized or completely polarized or unpolarized can be described by these sets of numbers called the Stokes vectors.
Now, I only did an undergraduate degree in pure maths, but if I remember correctly, that doesn't seem like you quite have enough information to get me a surface normal, because you would kind of need the degree of linear polarization and some orientation information, and it seems like you kind of don't quite have enough here to solve it fully. What am I missing?
So that's actually a very good observation. So one way to go about is once you've measured the Stokes parameters, you calculate what is called the degree of polarization. And that helps us recover one of the two degrees of freedom that are required to isolate a surface orientation over a full sphere of directions. And so think of it as the angle, incident angle, that describes how further away the surface is oriented from the camera direction. However, to describe the full 2D orientation, there is the other angle, which is called the azimuthal angle, that we need to recover, that describes how the surface orientation is oriented with respect to the camera viewing plane. So in the XY plane of the camera, basically, if the camera is looking down a Z axis, then there is this rotation of the surface normal in the XY plane. It's like a corkscrew around the Z direction. That is this phi angle that we need to recover, or the azimuthal angle. Now, it turns out that actually by measuring the Stokes parameters and doing the math that is described by Euler calculus, which is a calculus that was invented to basically discuss properties of polarization, then we do actually get information about the azimuthal angle, except that we can only recover the azimuthal angle up to a 180-degree rotation ambiguity. So think of it this way. We can tell whether the surface normal is pointing in the top right-hand quadrant direction or the bottom left-hand quadrant direction, but we cannot tell which of these two directions it is exactly pointing in.
So the Stokes stuff, you know, these phenomenon, actually, I should say the Brewster angle was known in like 1800, they just sort of discovered it. I think the calculus you're referring to is from the 1940s, from MIT. But what you guys are doing is, I think, great, because it actually takes all this and then it applies it to the kind of real world. As I was saying, the idea actually works pretty well on human faces, because you're making some assumptions or getting some guidelines from what tends to be the case if a person was, for example, standing outside under a cloudy day. Tell me how you're using that property of, like, basically the sky being brighter than the ground, and also the fact that most people's faces, unless they've had a horrendous accident, are convex instead of concave.
So we somehow need to break this rotational ambiguity, and for that we are looking at additional cues to help us make that decision. So for shapes that are mostly convex, like spherical objects, what we can do is first start from the silhouette edges of the object, where we definitely know that if there is a silhouette, then the surface normal is pointing away from the edge direction of the silhouette. And iteratively, then we can work inwards to classify the central directions based on what their neighbors on the silhouette edges had been classified as. So that's a flood sill approach that we use in this work. And it works very well for things that are very spherical. Now, for more complex shapes, which have a lot of concavities, however, you could get into local minima and get stuck in with the wrong classification. So for these kind of situations, we rely on additional incident lighting cues. So for example, if there is a directional information in the lighting, then we also exploit that to get the right classification. Now, it turns out when we are doing outdoor photography under cloudy sky conditions, then just naturally, because of the nature of the sky being brighter than the ground plane, there's more light coming from above and less bounce light coming from the ground plane, which results in a natural gradient of light from the top to the bottom direction. Now, this just natural gradient that we are recording is sufficient additional lighting cue that helps us break this rotational ambiguity and helps us recover the correct surface normal direction.
So I've got my person outside. I can now tell that their face is round, and I can tell basically what their surface normals are. But to do all of this, I actually have to have some way of reading this polarization at the camera end. So how is the camera actually, are you are you somehow doing some calibration? I mean, how do I know what the amount of polarization? I can tell it's polarized. It gets darker or lighter. I can tell because I can minimize reflections. But not, I'm not talking about telling whether it's polarized. I'm talking about actually reading the exact amount of polarization. How do you do that?
So that's a very good question. So in our work, we actually pre-calibrate three different sets of linear polarizers that are oriented in the horizontal orientation, the vertical orientation, and a 45-degree orientation, and an additional circular polarizer. And we mount these polarizers on a filter wheel that we rotate in front of the camera sequentially. So one after the other, we move one polarizer in front of the camera, take a picture, then move another polarizer in front of the camera using the wheel, and we record this. So in four photographs, we have recorded four polarization states because a different filter moved in front of the camera's lens and moved out. And then from these four photographs, we are then able to recover the Stokes parameters.
Now, we just touched on circular polarizers there, and I think you mentioned it again earlier. And obviously, most of us from school know what a polarizer is. We think of it being like a Venetian blind and light's coming in all these different wave angles, and only the waves that are get sort of in line with the Venetian blind, to use that analogy, get through. Just explain to people who don't know what a circular polarizer is, because it's maybe not as intuitive.
That's another interesting question you're raising. So as we all understand, linear polarizers restrict polarization to a specific plane, so in, either in the vertical direction or in the horizontal direction, and let light only the correct polarization through and block the other orientations. Circular polarization is really an interesting situation where basically the polarization is actually twisting in a coil along the direction of light propagation. The way such a light wavefront is generated is by putting a, what is called a quarter wave retarder in front of a linear polarizer and orienting this quarter wave retarder at a 45-degree angle with respect to the axis of the linear polarizer. Now, what that does is that once light goes through the linear polarizer and then hits the quarter wave plate, it gets split into two wave fronts that are linearly polarized but are 90 degrees phase shifted with respect to each other, which means you will get two linear wave fronts that are horizontally polarized and vertically polarized moving together in space. Now, the end effect of both of these wave fronts existing together is that it results in a circular coiling motion along the direction of light transport, and hence the name circular polarization.
Right. So we basically take these properties, and that gives us what we need to solve into first the Stokes with the Muller calculus. And now I really have the ability to look at a person with this technology and produce a 3D map of them. And actually, the results that you published are stunningly good. Did you expect to get such good results when you did the initial research?
So we were always apprehensive about the quality of the results under unpolarized incident illumination. Under polarized incident illumination, we already had a notion of the quality of the signal being sufficient to get decent surface normal information. So it was this apprehension about what happens when the light, incident light is unpolarized, and it was working with many different types of materials with different amounts of specularity was the challenge. And it turned out just by making the measurements and doing some filtering, we were able to recover sufficient signal, even though it was noisier than under polarized illumination.
So from my understanding of Stokes vectors from when I was studying math, I would have thought that I would need two things, because I would have imagined that I could get from what you've described a kind of vector, but I that would sort of, the degree of polarization would give me kind of what half of what I needed, but I'd also need some kind of orientation to get a really accurate place for the... So it feels like I haven't got quite enough information.
Right. So you're absolutely correct. So one way to use the Stokes vectors is to calculate what is called the degree of polarization. And that gives us some clues about the orientation of the surface normal, because it gives us one of the 2 degrees of freedom that are required to locate a surface normal over a full sphere of directions. Now, it turns out that in practice, it's a 2 degrees of freedom that we have to recover. And so by recording these four Stokes vectors with different filters in front of the camera, we actually do get information about the second degree, which is called the azimuthal angle in this case. And it is, in some sense, you could think of it as a, if you're looking down the negative Z direction, then it's basically a rotation in the orthogonal XY direction. It's a twisting coil rotation around that. And so to recover that rotation, there's something called the Mueller calculus of specular reflection, which if we just do the math, then we can actually recover this parameter out from the measurement of the Stokes vectors, except that we can only recover it up to a 180 degree rotation ambiguity, which means that we can know how much that angle is, except we don't know whether it's off by another 180 degrees or not. So we can tell whether we are at the top right-hand quadrant or the bottom left-hand quadrant, but we cannot tell which of the two quadrants we are in.
Now, as I was saying to you before, the great thing about this research you're doing is it seems to be that in the application of filming people, this always tends to be a bit more helpful than less. And here you use the property of, if I was shooting someone outside in a kind of overcast day, you actually have a kind of a natural gradient of light from the fact that the sky dome is obviously going to be brighter than the ground plane that's you know, obviously got incidental reflection. Describe how you use these properties and the fact that people's faces tend to be convex rather than concave.
Right. So that's a very good question that you just raised. So to break this ambiguity that I just talked about, if the object is very convex, so like very spherical, one way to work around this problem is we start from the silhouette, and basically we definitely know the direction of the surface normal at the silhouette because the normal has to be at an orthogonal direction to the edge of the silhouette. And iteratively, we can work inwards using a flood-fill approach where basically you first recover the normals of the silhouette and then you work inwards towards the center of the object. Now, this works well for mostly convex spherical shapes. But if the object is more complex in shape with more concavities, then such an algorithm might end up doing misclassification of the azimuthal angle. So for such scenarios, in our work we rely on extra lighting information. So if there is any directional cues that we get from the incident lighting itself, then that helps us break this ambiguity. A classic case is when we are outdoors in a cloudy sky and we are observing an object, it is naturally lit by more light coming from up top from the sky than from the bounce light from the ground plane. So the ground plane bounce lighting is darker than the sky lighting, the direct sky lighting, which is the result of direct sunlight that comes from the top. So if we know this information, then this gradient, natural gradient of light from the top direction to the down direction helps us in breaking this pi ambiguity or this 180 degree rotation ambiguity that I was talking about and helps us uniquely recover the surface normal map.
So if I have structured light and I'm filming this in a studio environment, I'm in a good position. Obviously, if I'm doing stuff that is outside, it's still working with this unstructured light that we're talking about. Let me ask you a couple of questions about what would happen if we change from what we've been talking about. So let's say I tried doing this outside in bright sunlight. Surely bright sunlight is still fairly unpolarized, isn't it? Just not scattered.
So while that's actually a very good question. So unintuitively in this scenario, things change when you have bright sunlight. While the bright sunlight itself is unpolarized, when light scatters through the open blue sky, the sky actually introduces a strong linear polarization on the incident illumination. So unlike in the cloudy sky environment, going out there and recording the Stokes parameters under like bright, sunny, open blue skies, you would actually not get unpolarized light. You'd actually get linearly polarized light. And it turns out that the math for recovering surface normals under those situations would be very different from the ones that I discuss in this paper for unpolarized light.
But didn't you try doing polarized light in the in the studio, and weren't you getting better results with structured light in the studio? Why would that not apply outside?
Right. So that is correct, except in the light stage control lighting environment in our lab, we were illuminating with circularly polarized light. And the reason to do that is, just like unpolarized light, circularly polarized light is also a spherically symmetric polarization condition, which means that the math that I discuss in the paper works from any arbitrary viewing direction. So I could record the same Stokes parameters from any viewpoint over the full sphere of directions, and we would use the exact same math to recover the surface normals. Now, when light is linearly polarized, as would happen under bright, sunny sky conditions, then it is no longer necessarily a spherically symmetric condition. It is actually a directional condition, and one would have to know the specific directionality of it to solve for the surface normal in those conditions.
So let me ask you this. We're in a studio, a film studio, and I set up some lights, and it's a sensible set. If I was to take a light probe reading, or effectively an HDR, stitched together light probe, would that be enough information about the nature and the direction of the light, or would that be just telling me where the light is but nothing about its polarization, and therefore I'm still not going to be any further advanced unless I can somehow scatter those lights in the studio?
So that's actually a very interesting point you're raising. So typically people go out there and record light probes to record the intensity of light and its distribution in a spherical environment. That would certainly help with forward simulation of how that light would then bounce around and how it would then potentially polarize with reflections. Now, if we are trying to illuminate that scene with polarized illumination, then one way to recover that would be to take a light probe, in this case a black ball or a chrome ball, and then record the Stokes parameters of the light probe, and then using the Stokes parameters of the measured spherical ball, recover the incident Stokes parameters of polarized illumination.
So let me see if I can summarize this correctly. As we've all got used to sticking in light probes, let's consider that a finite step we all know. So if I was to set up a studio and I wanted to use this technique, and let's imagine for a second that I'm going to solve the camera problem in 1 second, I might be able to do a light probe and a light probe that has samples for polarization. So I effectively do an extended light image probe, and then now I have kind of a baseline for the studio, and then from there I'd be able to work more on what's going on. But this still doesn't solve the problem that at the moment what we're talking about is pretty much what would need to be a still, because you have to change these polarizers in front of the lens to record different things on the actual hero image, even if I could back calculate it. Isn't that correct?
Right. So because it's a sequential capture, at least the light probe itself would have to be captured with a still camera. And provided that even the lighting itself is not changing, the actual recording of the data, so for example, if it's a human subject, the human subject's facial performance, for example, could then be captured with the person doing dynamic stuff. But the calibration with the light probe would have to be done with the camera and the light probe very static with respect to each other.
So let's say I've got an actor sitting there in a chair. What I'm hearing you say is that I could, could you step out for a second? I'm just going to set up my light probe. I'm going to do my light probe, and I'm going to do this sort of extended light probe that gives me the different polarization samples for my Stokes vectors. But now the actor sits back down in the chair.
Right.
Can I capture in real time the actor? I thought that you were saying earlier that I would have to do multiple captures per frame, or is it enough to just have...
Right. So that's actually a very good question. So there are several ways of doing this. One possibility would be to use multiple cameras that share an optical axis through, for example, a beam splitter, and then each one has its own polarizer that is a static polarizer.
I got to interrupt you there because I thought, again, sorry to be so rude, but I thought if I put a giant great mirror there, like from a stereo rig, that that mirror itself would start doing polarizing things and that that would not work.
Where did the stereo rig come from? I'm sorry,
you were saying that you were having multiple cameras sharing the same position, and I assumed you were doing that by doing a, you know, using like effectively like a stereo rig where the cameras are no longer separated in interaxial, and if you were just beam splitting, and if you're beam splitting whatever the rig is, mm-hmm. I thought the beam splitting itself would inherently introduce polarization.
So there are polarizing beam splitters, and then there are the non-polarizing beam splitters. As long as we account for the internal optics of the beam splitter, I think you could potentially still solve the problem.
Okay.
So I was only talking about recovering surface normals from a specific viewpoint.
Yep.
You could obviously then do stereo beyond the specific viewpoint,
yes,
of one camera. The other ways to go about is that there are cameras that are potentially coming out in the market that could have polarization sensing capabilities inbuilt on them. Typically cameras have these color filters inbuilt on them that allows them to sense different wavelengths of light, so such as the red, the green, and the blue. And so there are cameras that are currently coming out. These are probably more in the research prototyping phase and not yet completely, off-the-shelf cameras. But there certainly are such things that are being developed that could be doing the sensing of polarizations in addition to color. And so if you had such a camera, then you could potentially, at video rates, just record in one frame without having to use the beam splitting technique.
Okay, so now I've got my actor sitting there, and I've calibrated the room effectively, and I've got them, and I'm basically producing a, for want of a better term, a map or a sort of, I mean, basically it looks like a 3D mm-hmm. Person. And the question becomes, in that studio environment where I've got everything perfectly set up, I'm getting a pretty darn good map. How much worse is it if I move to the exterior cloudy day environment? In other words, when you leave the sanctuary of a great lab environment, how much worse does it get? Because we talked about it being still workable, but is it vaguely workable? Is it still a pretty good result? What's it like?
So that depends on whether when we're comparing it to studio environment, if the light inside the studio environment was unpolarized, then you are effectively in a very similar situation even outdoors. However, if the light inside the studio was actually polarized, then your signal-to-noise ratio or the quality of your signal deteriorates by approximately half. So you have more noise than before. However, we show in the paper that even under such scenarios, with effective filtering of the data and noise suppression, we can still recover reasonable normal surface normal information.
So at the outset, we discussed this, and you used the term dielectric. And dielectric, if you're actually looking it up in a dictionary, would probably refer to materials with high polarizability. So I guess the question comes, if I use something that is incredibly electrically conductive, that is not dielectric, like a car...
Like a metal.
Yeah, like a car. Right. And I put a car in this environment, am I getting any result, or it just doesn't work?
So our analysis in the paper does not include metallic objects. However, a separate set of equations could certainly be derived for metallic objects, and then the Mueller calculus could then be solved for such objects. It's just that our analysis in this paper was limited to dielectric objects.
And going the other way, imagine, you know, we talked about this human face having a certain amount of specular reflectivity. What if I put in something that was really, really diffuse and had almost no specula, like a giant piece of chalk outside in our sort of setup? Am I, again, getting no result because I don't get any kind of spec highlight, or do you still get a result?
Under normal circumstances, you would expect that the specular reflection to be really reduced, and that would really affect the quality of your data. and you would not get good surface normal recovery. However, in practice, what we found was that even in such materials, we found a significant measurement of circular polarization that results due to internal scattering of light, perhaps one, two, or three bounces. So not too many bounces to completely depolarize, but a sufficient number to actually pick up what is called circular polarization. And this additional channel of information that happens due to single or two or three scatters is an additional signal that helps us recover decent surface normal information, even in such extreme conditions.
Wow, because I kind of thought from my simple understanding of these things that light on, say, okay, so let's talk about skin for a second, skin that isn't that it doesn't have a good spec highlight, it's at an angle where you're not getting a lot of specularity, and it's certainly, you know, dry and very much looking like a diffuse property. I thought the whole idea is light goes in, its subsurface scatters around a lot and pops out at, you know, varying places. And the problem with doing that is because it's bounced around and popped out in varying places and not immediately reflected off the surface, it is diffuse. I mean, that's what it does. It diffuses and consequently would have no polarization, but you're still achieving something there?
Yeah, so that's exactly. It's a very counterintuitive result in some sense, because normally the result of diffuse reflection is basically light scatters so many times that if there was any inherent polarization, it would be lost by the time light comes out. And that is how most materials pick up color. And that is why different skin have different colors, is because of the different concentration of melanin inside the skin. And that is the result of multiple scattering. However, what we've noticed in our measurement and in our work is that there is some amount of light that is not necessarily the result of direct specular reflections, the direct bounce off the surface, but perhaps one or two or three bounces inside the material. So not so many bounces to completely depolarize, but just sufficient number of bounces to actually not only get polarized due to its internal scattering mechanism, but also have enough orientation information when it comes out. So this is, it actually turns out that under unpolarized incident illumination, these two or three bounce scatters cause an exitant circular polarization, which when we image using the Stokes measurements, we can actually recover some additional signals for surface orientation.
So is this also, I mean, is this applicable to humans? Is this why you're getting good results?
This is applicable to most dielectric materials that scatter.
So, in fact, we're getting obviously great results, you know, where we expect there to be specularity highlight, but we're still getting surprisingly better than we should get results for the non sort of spec type areas, because this effect is most pronounced specularly.
Right. So that's exactly correct. So at Brewster angle, you have the strongest signal, but when you like for frontal directions, where basically the specular reflection is least polarized. Because of this exident extra circular polarization information that we image, we are still able to recover good surface normal information in those regions.
Well, look, it's been fascinating talking to you, and I really hope to see this research picked up and continued on, because obviously for us it's the holy grail. If you could film with a camera, even if you had to do some calibration beforehand, and actually have a surface normal map that was one of the channels that you got out, just like you get an RG or a B channel, wow, what a world we'd live in, and how helpful that would be to so many problems that we face in the world of image processing and also just general post-production and visual effects. Abhijit, I can't thank you enough for taking time to sort of walk me through that. I hope it hasn't been too painful for you to dumb down your research.
Not at all. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about this work. And I'm so excited that I'm able to share this work with you. Thank you.
Well, thanks for that, guys. I should mention we also did an earlier FX podcast with Paul Debevic from ICT on the single shot light probe, which was also part of the same sets of talks at SIGGRAPH LA. So if you enjoyed this one, check that out. I'd like to thank our FX Insider members who support the site through their contributions. As a thanks for donations made as part of the FX Insider program, we give you exclusive access to additional content. Things like member-only articles, additional effects breakdowns, and more. Details can be found at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. In addition to the FX podcast you've been listening to, we do two other regular audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects in current releases as well as classic films. The RC podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. If you enjoyed this podcast, we'd also recommend our HD video podcast, FX Guide TV. And as I mentioned, we also have a sister site, FX PhD, that offers extensive online visual effects training. Well, that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.